Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, February 19th, 2024. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio. This week, we're looking back at the legislative session in Santa Fe that ended last week. In just a couple of minutes, correspondent Gwyneth Dolan speaks with two journalists who were at the Capitol the last few weeks to recap what's headed to the governor's desk and what fell short. But first, let's get into some of the other headlines from around the state. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is hinting at the possibility of a special session focused on crime and public safety following the end of the 30-day legislative session. During a press conference marking the conclusion of the budget session last week, the governor pointed out only five public safety initiatives have reached her desk. That list includes creating a 7-day waiting period for gun sales, banning guns at polling places statewide, increasing sentences for attempted murder charges, allowing more retired state workers to fill public safety positions while still collecting their pensions, and forcing courts to jail people accused of multiple felonies. While Democratic legislators celebrated these bills passing, Republicans criticized the focus on gun control over tackling root issues like mental health and holding repeat offenders in jail. The chance of a special session is uncertain, but Lujan Grisham said she's optimistic about the legislators' willingness to consider more public safety measures. We'll let you know if and when the governor decides to call lawmakers back to Santa Fe for that special session. A bill to require no-means-no policies at public universities and colleges across the state is headed to the governor's desk after passing the legislature last week. House Bill 151 passed the State House 3822 and would require public colleges and universities to include affirmative consent education in student orientation materials. It would require them to adopt trauma-informed policies for assisting sexual or domestic abuse victims and make connections for sexual violence resources. During floor debates on the bill, lawmakers zeroed in on alleged assaults on the New Mexico State University basketball team, which led to an $8 million settlement for the victims. Introduced by Representative Liz Thompson, the bill failed last year, and it didn't make it through this year without some major changes. The original proposal included affirmative consent policies for grades kindergarten through 12th grade, instead of just public colleges and universities. Opponents, mainly Republicans, raised concerns about its potential impact on those who were falsely accused, while supporters say it will help promote healthy relationships and prevent assault. I'll be speaking with Representative Liz Thompson this week on New Mexico in Focus. New Mexico lawmakers are asking the State Department of Health to investigate the potential benefits of a psychedelic therapy program focused on psilocybin mushrooms. Unlike a similar measure that failed last year, Senate Memorial 12 doesn't ask for funding. Instead, it would build a foundation of knowledge by curating studies and reports on psilocybin therapy and examining what other states have done. Depending on how all of that works out, sponsors say a bill to create a funded program could be introduced as soon as 2025. Supporters point to evidence showing success with psilocybin-assisted therapy for various mental health conditions. Veterans groups and medical professionals are among those advocating for the therapeutic potential of psilocybin and point to programs in states like Colorado and Oregon. The University of New Mexico will work with the Department of Health to conduct the research. With the focus of addressing mental health challenges, particularly in a state with high suicide rates, sponsors say the memorial highlights the need for swift but careful action to explore the healing benefits of psychedelics. The 2024 New Mexico legislative session has ended, and as we wait to see if the governor follows through on calling a special session to address public safety, we're going to look back at what did and didn't make it through the 30-day stint for lawmakers. Later in the show, executive producer Jeff Proctor interviews Sophia Genovese, an attorney with the New Mexico Immigrant Law Center, about a failed bill that would have prohibited New Mexico cities and counties from contracting with the federal government to detain asylum seekers. During that conversation, the two talk about the inhumane conditions detained asylum seekers are experiencing in ICE prisons, and Jeff asks why state Democrats helped kill the proposal that would have ended those contractual relationships. And to close the show, we'll head back inside the roundhouse one more time with Gwyneth Dolan, who catches up with several lawmakers and policy advocates to talk about a wide range of influential items. But we begin with Gwyneth's three-part conversation with two journalists recapping New Mexico's 2024 legislative session. Here's Gwyneth.
Thanks, Lou. Joining us today at our virtual roundtable, we have Source New Mexico editor Sean Griswold and Tripp Jennings, executive director of New Mexico In Depth. Glad to have you here, guys.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the budget. This was their one job, and lawmakers sent a $10.2 billion budget to the governor. Let's just hit some of the highlights. Sean, it was a bigger budget than last year, not hugely bigger, 6.8% bigger. Still, the Rio Grande Foundation said it was a fail and padded with giveaways. Source New Mexico was there for the debate over the budget in the Senate. What was that discussion like? I want to ask you. Democrats hugely outnumber Republicans in the legislature and in the Senate. Did Democrats steamroll this budget, or was there GOP support for it?
The budget did have substantial support from Republicans in both the House and the Senate. And the major debate really does come off to the issue of reserves. You know, New Mexico is in a surplus. That's why we're in another record budget spending session. But the concern that was brought up in a lot of the debate from both Republicans and Democrats was, how much are we going to continue with this cash flow? Obviously, that's dependent on oil and gas activity. And the concern is that industry can at times be volatile. So by saving money and putting money in reserves, the idea is that we're going to set this budget up to a point where when and if that actual industry starts to falter and New Mexico starts seeing fewer revenues from that, that the state won't have to do drastic cuts with the investments that it is doing. But I think what was substantial out of the debate is Senator George Munoz, who was really prominent in leading the budget conversation, is telling the Mexicans, you're not a poor state. Stop thinking you're poor. And that's coming from this identity of, we are spending money on not only our government, but also initiatives to support people in the state.
Yeah, there was a big surplus, $3.5 billion in mostly extra oil and gas money. And the, like squirrels, lawmakers stashed some of those acorns away, like $1 billion worth of acorns away, in funds and endowments aimed at creating what they were all calling future money. So there were funds created and plumped up for water, housing, transportation, college scholarships and tuition, conservation. Trip, you've got the long view here. You've been watching this legislature almost 20 years. Are we looking at a major change in strategy in the state budget?
I think, yes, as lawmakers and policymakers in New Mexico are looking 20 to 30 years ahead and seeing this, or maybe even 10 years, looking at this moment where the Permian Basin isn't producing as much oil and gas that, you know, basically helps with also the massive trust. Those revenues help produce, what is it, 40 to 45% of the state budget every year, oil and gas. And so to Sean's point with the operational reserves, which is like, you know, what you have in the budget, that's for year in, year out. They're thinking about, we need to create these trust funds that will, you know, if you're, let's take it down to a family. If you're a wealthy family, you've got, say, $10 million. Do you spend it all right now, or do you set it in investments and then live off the interest, which can actually be pretty substantial? And that's kind of the principle here. That's what they're thinking about. And that will, their thinking is, in the future, that will reduce the volatility of the state budget. The question is how much? Because if you have these trust funds that are funding state agencies, sort of like the early childhood department, which has billions in their trust, which is producing a lot of money to fund the agency. So they're you know, this is, I think it's, yeah, they are thinking ahead, not just a couple of years, but decades in there with these trust funds and endowments. That's how I view this.
I want to talk about taxes. The House put together a $200 million package that included income taxes for everyone, especially people who make the least. They also cut the capital gains tax deduction. So those who are earning money, you know, on investments, real estate, they can only deduct about $2,500. They flattened the corporate tax rate to 5.9%. Which will raise it by about $500 a year for businesses that bring in less than $500,000. Trip, how does this package compare to last year's tax package?
Yeah, this was it's very interesting. They really had a strategy around this thing, because last year the tax package, the omnibus tax package, was about $1 billion in cost. And a lot of that was the tax rebates that the governor had wanted to send to New Mexicans. What happened last year is that she used, because it was an appropriation bill, and under the Constitution, state Constitution, if there's an appropriation bill, the governor has line item veto authority. So what she did basically was, you know, line item veto most of that omnibus tax bill last year. This year, they made a concerted effort to create a omnibus tax package that, you know, Tax and Rev House Chairman Derek Lente said is unvetoable, I think, is during the early part of the session. What he meant was is like online item vetoable. And so she can veto the bill if she wants. It's not going to do, because it raises revenue for the, I think, you know, well, anyway, it's a tax package. Sorry, I'm getting off on stuff. There's a lot of provisions here, and they didn't want her to be able to go into this line item veto authority. With this line item veto authority, that's why it's smaller than last year. Because basically, if the rebates is an appropriation, she could have used the line item veto authority. That's the strategy.
Yeah, and we'll talk more in a minute about some of the things that are in there. But something I remembered from Source New Mexico's reporting is you guys, Sean, did a lot of work covering the fires in northern New Mexico. There's some relief in the tax package for people impacted by the fires. Am I right?
Yes, and this has to do specifically with some of the representation that families or residents or individuals who are going through the federal FEMA process to rebuild their homes. And there's some of that tax rebates that will go directly to individuals who have either had their claims approved or in the process of getting it, or when they finally do get it, will be able to receive some money back in expenditures they've spent ahead of before they got their claims. Now, that obviously is an issue, because we're seeing a very slow rollout with FEMA dollars that goes to pay for people's rebuilding of their homes, tending their property. And so a lot of people have already put up money to get that going just so they have a place to live. And so these rebates are, in a sense, a way to help recover some of that money, while also potentially even supporting a bit of the legal representation that some people have had to use to utilize in navigating the federal system. Now, that is going to be something that we're going to be following a little bit more, because now you're essentially providing the lawyers a little bit of a tax rebate for services that were already paid for. So we'll have more on that as we understand a little bit more about what that does.
And Tripp, New Mexico In Depth did a lot of reporting, a major series on alcohol in New Mexico, and the alcohol tax. There was another big push again this year. Real briefly, what happened?
Basically, that was, it died in committee in the House Tax and Revenue Committee last Friday. Partly it's because now you have competing bills that have totally different rationales or strategies for how to handle the crisis. We lead the nation in alcohol-related deaths, the rates. And so it basically, in a sense, it was doomed by, competing bills among Democrats.
And a powerful lobby also.
Yeah, that's very true. Very true, yes.
Big picture here, do you guys think this tax package represents, in terms of some of its priorities, especially some of the green energy credits and things like that, tax cuts for New Mexicans, higher corporate tax rate, capital gains, does this represent the increasing liberal bent in the legislature? Is that what we're seeing? Sean, do you think so?
I mean, I would say that it falls in line. I don't know necessarily I would call it a liberal bent, because the majority party in the federal government is Democrats. And I believe that they're kind of falling in line with a lot of the federal policies that are providing tax credits on a federal level and codifying them at a state level to match what the feds are doing. You bring up, clean energy or even electrification, you're going to see more tax credits that New Mexico is lining itself with the federal policies of the current federal administration. And so that's why I believe it's less liberal, it's more status quo and keeping New Mexico up with a lot of the federal dollars that are coming into the state. And we're seeing a lot of that, kind of process being built in, so New Mexico can actually receive a lot of the federal infrastructure money that is available for the state.
Tripp, let me come to you on this. We've got about a minute left. Looking back 20 years, a big change in the legislature's makeup since then. Do you see some of what is happening now as reflecting a younger, more liberal, more diverse membership?
You know, I would say so, because back in the Richardson years, back 2003, his first year, they basically had an income tax. It was highest rate was 8.2, lowest rate was 4.9. They staggered it over several years to get a flat tax, 4.9%. This actually, the tax brackets, the lowest income earners are going to be paying less than they were before, as I understand the tax package. So while I agree with Sean, I totally get what he's saying. I do think in the state, it does reflect this younger, more urban, more progressive kind of like leadership that you're seeing in the House and the Senate, well, in the House especially.
The governor and environmental groups each had ambitious agendas this year. Different, but ambitious. We just heard about some of that. But neither group got a lot of what they wanted. Tripp, do you think that this lack of movement on climate and environment issues has to do with this being a 30-day budget session, or is it the oil and gas lobby flexing?
Honestly, it's both and instead of either or. It is a 30-day session. As we know, that's primarily the budget. As you said, leading off the show, this is, you know, they had one big job and it's the budget. As we all know, there's a lot of movement in the 30-day session, a lot of flurry of activity. You don't have the margin of error for getting something through is lessened and diminished during a 30-day session. So there's that. But, you know, oil and gas lobby, again, oil and gas revenues through all its revenue streams pays for 40 to 45% of the budget, you know, in that range every year in, year out. So they have a lot of influence up at the state house, as we all know. So it's, to me, it's both and.
Mm-hmm. Lawmakers did approve some green energy tax credits in the package for geothermal electricity, geothermal heat pumps for consumers, solar market tax credit, clean car tax credit that includes used EVs and chargers, advanced energy equipment that's for solar and wind equipment used in the bigger production. Sean, what happened to the governor's plan for a strategic water supply? Source has been all over this.
Yes, and I do have to, you know, to begin with, Danielle Prokop, our reporter here, educates me every single day on water in New Mexico, and it's a complex thing. She talks about water as a language in New Mexico, and that's what we heard about. So to, in short, the strategic water supply is a culmination of multiple water experts and stakeholders and industry people trying to develop how New Mexico can create a commodity market for water that is coming from oil and gas industry. This is used water that is used to produce and frack. All that money we're receiving goes, a lot of our water goes to create that. So the state wanted to create a commodity market where it can treat that water, turn it into a something solvable, and sell it to other states. Now, we didn't have any details about this, even though this was a prominent initiative for the governor that started at the, not only in the state of the state, but even months before the session started. Still had no details. Got some small minor details about it through the session, where there was a $500 million investment in this new program to establish this thing. That completely changed. At the very last minute, the governor was able to, the governor and her administrators and her supporters in the legislature brought a proposal up in the last week of the session that would have cut this investment to $100 million and also would have cut out the oil and gas industry potable water they used and only used brackish water. And from what we heard in sort of the process as to how this happened, advocates were completely opposed to the idea. They called it a bit of a bailout for industry. Industry never even spoke up in support for it in any committee hearings that it was spoken about. And so it was a little bit of a stumble by the governor on this part. While it was a major initiative, the criticisms that we heard from a lot of people about it was her position on moving it and pushing it through the legislature was a bit sloppy in a lot of ways. And ultimately now this thing is going to have to happen in a potential next session if it actually will.
Yeah, that was a big idea and a big lift for a 30-day. I want to talk about good government for a minute. Legislators put a lot of money toward capital outlay this year. They had the money and, you know, they threw some at old projects that needed to get finished. And there's a lot of new stuff in here. for infrastructure. Tripp, you and I have spent a lot of time over the years talking about the lack of transparency in capital outlay. It used to be sort of a mega slush fund and kind of a mess. Have they gotten better about it?
Well, you know, in the last few years, I mean, yes, they've gotten better because in coming weeks, you'll see with the capital outlay bill, they will actually list all the, you know, sponsors of every project. They used not to do that. It took 6 or 7 years to actually get that reform after we reported in 2015 that you know, that we didn't know who was sponsoring what projects. So they have gotten better about that. I will say with the you know, if you guys were paying attention in the waning days of the session, Senator George Munoz, who is the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, said next year he's probably not going to sign off on reauthorization for capital funding for old projects.
And this was the trouble we used to have. They'd throw some money at it, but not enough to get it finished, and it never went anywhere, and that money kind of languished.
Yeah.
I noticed they've added, you know, they've added this transparency, and in several places, they've added more accountability measures. Junior bill money used to be a pile of earmarks, and now they've turned that into the GROW, G-R-O projects that not only have some transparency to them, more transparency, but also some accountability, which is interesting. I want to talk about education here for a minute. We up at the Capitol talked about some changes to the graduation requirements, making them more flexible. And throughout the session, we heard more about increasing opportunities for CTE, career technical education, internships, training, helping students move straight from high school into high-paying trades. Lawmakers gave raises to teachers, 3%, put more money toward the lottery and opportunity scholarships. One thing that passed late in this session was a bill requiring affirmative consent. Sean, Source New Mexico had a story about affirmative consent. Can you just give us some insight there?
Yeah, this has been a proposal that's is about 5 years in the making. It was an element that would provide a lot of the ideas of how you talk about sexual relationships in K through 12 is how it originally started. This year's version was focused predominantly on higher education. The supporters for the bill cut out the K through 12 elements, made it to higher ed. A lot of it was in response to the hazing lawsuit that happened at New Mexico State University with their basketball team. It passed through the Senate. And what it does, it actually really just aligns with some of the federal standards you have with Title IX in providing resources and support for victims who are of sexual assault and harassment, and providing resources for students at the very beginning when they get to college about this is how you need to deal with interactions, training in a way when it comes to navigating the elements of just generally working with being around people.
And I should say that, you know, we've covered this here at New Mexico in Focus. UNM has been doing this for a long time. So this is not actually a significant change because it only applies to higher ed. Like you said, it would have been very significant if it had applied to K-12. Tripp, your colleague Bella Davis covered the effort to pass a Tribal Education Trust Fund. I thought that was in the budget. I saw money in the budget for that. What happened?
So, yes, you did see money in the budget. What happened was, and, you know, this was the second year that it was proposed. This year, they had a year to kind of prepare. What happened is it looked like it was going to pass. $50 million in the budget. Again, this is the model of like $50 million. Then it produces interest that the tribes could then use to actually help with their own educational, like their own educational programs within their communities and also in urban and other areas off the communities. What happened was in the end, in the last days, it looked like it was going to pass 66-0 or something like 68-0, maybe in the House. They passed it out, looked like it had momentum. And then it kind of like just basically stalled in the Senate. In the last couple of days, we started hearing word that maybe there was some, maybe some people had some problems with it. And yesterday, the House Tax Chairman, Committee Chairman Derek Lente told Bella that he was going to pull the bill. It was sitting on the floor, and there were going to be Senate floor. There are going to be a lot of amendments, and he just didn't think he could get it through in time, and he asked Peter Wirth not to run it.
Sean, we have about a minute left here. What does this mean for education for tribes and pueblos, and how do you think the legislature did overall in responding to their legal obligations of resulting from the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit?
Well, what's going to happen is, you see my buddy here, Robert Knott, just for a second showed up. He wanted to sign in. But what this means is that New Mexico is going to be in Yazzie Martinez for probably decades. I imagine we're going to be covering this mandated education reform probably for the rest of our careers in journalism and for the next group that's coming up.
Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham made public safety a priority this year. She announced more than 20 initiatives, and she talked about improving outcomes for people that could prevent crime. But Sean, what did lawmakers send her on guns? She had a lot of ideas. What happened?
Well, she had two ideas that end up on her desk, and even those ideas were amended and diluted in a way from their original proposals. Number one, you have now a 7-day waiting period to purchase a gun. That was originally proposed as a 14-day waiting period. The second bill that's out on her desk is the banning of weapons at polling places, and that was also amended to where if you have a concealed carry permit, you can actually take your gun and vote if you feel like you need to. So even with those gun bills that are on her desk that she is expected to sign, they were also amended and diluted in a way that didn't get exactly what she wanted.
Yeah, and in terms of other kind of tough on crime ideas, she did get an increased penalty for second degree murder. She did not get increased flexibility for prosecutors who want to hold people behind bars when they're accused of serious crimes. Now, Tripp, it's an election year. Do you think lawmakers are going to leave Santa Fe with something to brag about with what they've done on crime? And also, how important is that outside of the cities, really?
I mean, it really depends on who you're talking about as far as a lawmaker goes. If you're, in a rural district and you're basically, you've got a lot of constituents who are like, hey, we need our guns. We're in rural parts of the state. The 7-day waiting period, which some people in the urban, some progressives or people in the urban areas will go, that's a great big win. They might say, well, we don't need that, in rural parts of the state. Elsewhere, like I said, maybe in urban areas or more progressive leaning areas, that is a big win for people who are supportive of that stuff. Similar to the guns in the public places. I mean, let's face it, gun violence is a big issue here in New Mexico, as it is across the state. Every week, we just had something happen in Kansas City, this week, where there was a shooting. Every week we, run around, we hear about news around gun violence. So I think it really depends on who you're talking to on election year and how they can use it in their platforms as they're running.
Not a massive liberal win, but not a massive conservative defeat either. Sean, thinking about some of the things the governor framed in her State of the State address in terms of the root causes of crime, she talked about the state's housing crisis, and they did get a little movement there, didn't they?
Yes. So the governor was also looking for another $500 million in investments to create more agencies within the state to develop money to invest in housing development. Now, that didn't go. That was also cut a little bit. But what she does have right now is about $175 million to go into an agency that will now look to develop ways to invest in development of homes for people who are not low income, mostly the people in the middle. Don't make enough money to purchase a home, don't make enough or make more than to receive any type of subsidies. And so she's really trying to make this as a investment for developers to provide those homes and those options for home buyers. And that's going to be something we're going to have to follow. That's going to become another issue into next year as well.
Yeah, it's a real challenge for folks who are just starting out their careers now. The home prices have changed a lot. Sean, sticking with you for a minute, there was a bid to require paid family medical leave, and that failed at the end, but it looked like it was going to pass. What happened?
Well, looks and appearances are very important because this has had a very strong support from not only Senate leadership, but advocacy and lobbyist groups have been highly prominent in it. They bring in dozens, if not hundreds, of people throughout the year to lobby on behalf of this workers, people who are general New Mexicans. And it failed on a very short vote. And similar to what we saw with some of the gun legislation, you have conservative Democrats in the state who are aligning themselves with Republicans in ways that they feel like not only will it support their rural ideals, but also their business interests. And you had several Democrats vote against the bill that did ultimately kill paid family medical leave.
Yeah, and I saw a lawmaker say, now I can't remember if it was a Democrat or Republican, saying, what, my chamber is against this, you know, the business community is really against this. How am I supposed to go home from Santa Fe and say that I did this to hurt the business community? And that's a tough call. Again, this was a 30-day session packed with non-budget related items. Advocates for modernizing the legislature, helping them do more, wanted longer sessions. They didn't get it. They wanted pay for state lawmakers. Didn't get it. What they did get was $6 million in the budget for paid staff. Tripp, what kind of difference do you think that will make?
I mean, I think it will help lawmakers. As we know, they're a volunteer; they're not paid a salary. Basically, the hope is that when you have professional year-round staff, that they can do a constituent work. Maybe they can help lawmakers do that. They also can do research for lawmakers. This is really important. As
Especially
we
with
reported,
the complexity of some of the bills we saw this
yes.
session.
That's right. And what you have is with every legislative body, Congress, other state legislatures, later, legislature, sorry, lobbyists have a lot of influence. But when you have a volunteer legislature, lobbyists have even more, influence on writing bills, technical assistance. Possibly these professional staff might be able to maybe push up against that. Not saying that lobbyists are bad, they're part of the system. They've been part of the system since the founding of the country.
You're
But
right.
yeah.
And you know, I had, as you know, Tripp, because both of you helped me, I had 14 UNM journalism students with me up at the session this year, and they learned a ton about the value of lobbyists and about the
Yes.
expertise that they have. So that's a strong point. You know, a lot of lobbyists are former lawmakers. A lot of them have been there decades longer than any of the elected officials. So paid staff does have the potential to counteract some of that. Speaking of these lawmakers, a lot of state senators announced that they're retiring. At least eight. That's Tallman, Pirtle, Schmides, McKenna, Griggs, Neville, Moores, and Jerry Ortizipino. That's actually 20%, just about 20% of the state Senate that will be new next session. Over the past few years, we've seen a sea change in the makeup of the state house, right? It's now majority women, people of color, many younger people. Is this what's coming next for the state Senate? And what would that mean? Sean, what do you think?
Yes, to answer your question, that's exactly what it's going to be. We're going to see a whole new blend of makeup of what New Mexico is. New Mexico is completely different than so many other states, and we all know that through our diversity of just who we are as a people and our culture and everything. And that's going to be reflected in a lot of these spaces. Now we will still see, because they are a volunteer legislature, a lot of people who are in prominent spots, who are lawyers, who can take the time to, volunteer for a month or 2 months out of a year to do this role, but they will come with the values that are going to be part of what New Mexico is. Now, some of those people you do rep that you mentioned are Republican representatives who represent very conservative districts that are flush with cash in the oil and gas industry. And so we may start seeing even more prominent oil and gas advocates who may have some sort of liberal social viewpoints on social policies, but are ultimately there to protect the industry that is funding all of this.
Tripp Jennings, one word, redistricting. How much change are we going to see in the Senate with these eight seats?
I mean, that's a really interesting question, because I just learned that my senator is no longer my senator because of the redistricting. I just learned this during the session. So
Now you're in
that
Rio Rancho, so
I
that
am.
is a potential swing, but the rest of
Yes.
these seats are pretty solid, aren't they?
No, but you're right, because it's got you're exactly. Rio Rancho can, depending on how that district is fashioned, it will be a swing district. You're exactly right.
Last question here. Previewing the next session, we're going to have a bunch of changes. We're going to have new butts in seats. But what do you think are some of the issues that we're going to be talking about? Maybe things that didn't happen and are going to come back next session. Sean, what's on your in your notebook for next session?
I think we're going to see paid family medical leave make another return. That's not going to end. I think we're going to see a lot of bills that were structured this year, like we talked about housing with the trust fund. You know, that bill is establishing essentially an administrative office to develop how to invest that money and build it out. Now, next year, they're going to come back and ask for more money because now they have the infrastructure set up. So we're going to see a lot of these trust funds that have been discussed recently now turn into asking for more money to either keep it going or even adopt some of the programming and the programs that they are trying to do, and then get those funded in other ways. So while it is budget and we're spending the money, we're going to now see next session what the what how you turn real money into something real, and that's what we're going to see a lot more next year.
Guys, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for taking this time with us and for breaking it down and for your work over the last 30 days. Both you, Tripp and Sean, and your teams, we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks to Tripp and to Sean and Gwyneth for those conversations. Now, going into this year's session with the support of House Speaker Javier Martinez, advocates were cautiously optimistic about an immigration detention reform proposal. The Dignity Not Detention bill would have barred New Mexico cities and counties from entering into contracts with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement to detain asylum seekers. That bill met an early end in the Senate this month, as six Democrats joined Republicans and another three vanished before the vote to kill the bill by just three votes. Sophia Genovese, an attorney with the New Mexico Immigrant Law Center, stopped by our studio and told executive producer Jeff Proctor when she knew that the bill's life would be cut short.
Sophia, thank you very much for coming and welcome back to New Mexico in Focus.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard from Lou that Senate Bill 145, which has commonly been known as the Dignity Not Detention bill, died on the Senate floor in an incredibly narrow vote for the second year in a row. And I want to get your reaction and sort of a description of how that happened. But I'd like to start with having you tell my viewers how many of these immigration detention facilities there are in New Mexico and where they're located.
Absolutely. So New Mexico has three immigration detention facilities. These are supposed to be operated by ICE, but instead what we do see is ICE subcontracting these responsibilities out to counties, who then subcontract those responsibilities out to private prison companies. And so New Mexico has three of these facilities. We have Torrens County Detention Facility, Cibola County Correctional Center, and Otero County Processing Center. In the case of Torrens and Cibola, these are both owned and operated by CoreCivic, which is a Tennessee-based private prison company. And it's really interesting, the contractual relationship. ICE contracts with the counties, who then contract with these companies. And that allows ICE to circumvent ordinary procurement requirements that you typically see in federal contracts with private corporations. By contracting with the counties, ICE gets to sidestep these responsibilities. And that goes along with, you know, not having to look into the performance history of these companies. And so the counties are really operating as shields to accountability. And in the case of Otero County actually owns that facility, but contracts out with the private prison companies. All three of these facilities detain asylum seekers who've recently arrived from the southern border. Torrens and Cibola, they hold asylum-seeking men, and then in Otero, we see men and women. Again, these are recently arrived asylum seekers. Under federal law, their detention is completely discretionary. It's truly random who gets deported, who gets detained, and who gets released at the border. It's up to the discretion of Border Patrol agents. But this decision impacts lives so significantly. We see people in detention lose their cases at far greater rates than people who are not detained and able to seek asylum from the comforts of their homes and have access to holistic services. in New Mexico, there's six of us doing this work, six attorneys providing representation to detained asylum seekers to a population of about 2,000 people. That's just not enough people to ensure due process, to ensure that everyone has access to the asylum system. So as a result, we see tremendous due process violations on top of what we think are ordinary systemic prison conditions, poor conditions, inhumane conditions that people are subjected to.
That was actually going to be my next question. In New Mexico, what are these places like?
All three facilities are horrifically understaffed. I think that's a problem across prisons in New Mexico generally, and it's certainly the case in these three facilities. And that leads to a number of problems. People are subjected to prolonged periods of solitary confinement because they're simply forgotten about. We hear all the time how people are put in medical quarantine for 2 weeks and not given enough food in those time periods. The facilities themselves are struggling. There's crumbling infrastructure. There's regular sewage leaks. People in Torrance, for example, were sleeping in sewage in their dorms because they couldn't get staff out there to fix it quickly enough. There's medical deficiencies, and I think language plays a part of that barrier in accessing services. We recently had someone who was deaf who couldn't communicate his needs because there wasn't a Spanish sign language interpreter. And so there's a myriad of issues really, but it comes down to understaffing and a lack of accountability.
So let's talk a little bit about Senate Bill 145, the parade of horribles that you just laid out. What would that bill specifically have done to address that and this question more broadly?
SB 145 built on a movement of states saying that they would no longer be complicit in the human suffering that is systemic in ICE detention. And what it specifically does is prohibit contracts between local state entities and ICE for the purposes of civil immigration detention. These contracts are discretionary for public entities to enter into. Nothing under federal law requires public entities to be involved in civil immigration enforcement. And so SB 145 really went after those contracts to prohibit these types of agreements, to increase accountability, but really to try and get New Mexico out of the business of detaining people for civil immigration violations.
One more question before we get to what happened to the bill, just so that my viewers are crystal clear here. When you talk about asylum seekers, what does that mean legally? Are these folks who are in fact accused of committing a crime?
No, people who are crossing the border and seeking asylum are absolutely not committing any crimes. In fact, one must be within the United States jurisdiction, within our territories, to seek asylum. It's not possible to simply apply from Mexico and wait your turn in line. That's not how the law works. It requires one to actually be here. And so when one seeks asylum, says they want to file an asylum application, they are not committing a crime.
Okay, so let's get to the bill and sort of what happened to it. It really seemed, at least from where I was sitting early in the session, like the bill had some momentum this time. Were you optimistic in a way that you weren't last year? What was the messaging from the legislature and from the governor around the bill heading into the session this year?
We came into the session with so much community support. There are so many faith groups across the state, community groups across the state who galvanize and organize over the past year to support this bill, recognizing the horrors that are occurring in these facilities. And so we went into the session very confident, cautiously optimistic because it's 30 days, but we were optimistic. And we had the support of leadership, we had the support of Speaker Javier Martinez, who has made this a priority, and we felt confident. And we felt confident after our first Senate committee hearing, and after our second committee hearing, we thought we were really going to get this passed.
Tell me a little bit about what you heard during the debate on the Senate floor, and how did that change your outlook for the prospects of the bill? Was it crystal clear to you that this was going sideways again once it got to the floor?
We received indication shortly before the floor debate that some deals had been made, and what those deals were not entirely clear. But by the time we got to the floor, we knew that we had lost some votes for a variety of reasons. And the floor debate really wasn't much of a debate. It was several legislators making statements that were quite offensive and not based in fact. And so it was more performative than actual legislative work happening on the floor.
So then what happened when it came time to vote?
We knew, again, that we didn't have the votes. What we heard instead were people justifying their no votes, people who had previously been supportive, trying to say, well, it'd be better if people were detained in New Mexico because we're a welcoming state. We're much better than Texas. Or these folks need to be detained because they're military-aged men who are going to, who knows, invade the country is what essentially we were hearing on the floor. We heard a lot of racist and xenophobic remarks and things, again, that just weren't based in reality.
So the new slogan for New Mexico should be better than Texas?
That's what the justification was on the floor. And again, it's not based in reality. New Mexico has some of the worst facilities in the country. The Office of the Inspector General has twice called for the closure of Torrance County Detention Facility. This is the government's own watchdog calling for a closure of a facility. That has never happened before. That is pretty clear indication that we have some of the worst facilities here.
Why does this keep happening? Why do these bills continue to be proposed, seem like they're cruising, and then meet these incredibly razor-thin margins when they get to a floor vote? Why does this keep happening?
It's a good question, and I don't know if I have the perfect answer, but I think there's fear in communities. It's not accurate fear, but there's a fear that, oh, okay, we're gonna take away jobs if we cancel these contracts, when in reality, these prisons would stay open if this bill were to pass and these facilities are all understaffed. It's probably not gonna result in job loss. It's not gonna result in less money coming to the counties when there's a variety of initiatives to spur economic development in the locations where these facilities are, such as the geothermal bill or SunZia, and lots of sustainable energy jobs that are making their way to these locations. So I think it's a misplaced fear that's not based in reality.
So I think a lot of viewers will be good and well familiar with congressional and executive failures at the federal level to deal with migration. Now the New Mexico legislature has declined for two consecutive years to address these particular detention facilities. What does that say to people who land in our state and are seeking asylum?
Yeah, I think in the situation of immigration detention, state legislation is the most effective way to handle these injustices. This is a situation where the state legislature has a tremendous amount of power, more power than the congressional delegation, frankly, to do something about this, to step in and stand up for human rights. And now, you know, we have to go back to the drawing board because we know our federal advocacy is not going to work in an election year. We're not going to convince the president and Secretary Mayorkas to cancel these contracts. We've tried and they've told us absolutely not. And so we will be regrouping over the next year to really demonstrate to legislators who voted no or walked away from voting that this bill is critical to preserving human rights and ensuring that no more deaths occur in New Mexico's ICE facilities.
Where are asylum seekers to turn for either redress of grievance or for help?
There are three organizations providing services to people in detention, and we do our best to monitor human rights abuses. My organization, we're in these facilities weekly, and we submit complaint after complaint to the oversight agencies in the federal government. And the oversight agencies, I think, are sympathetic. As I mentioned earlier, the Office of Inspector General has called for the closure of Torrance twice, but at the end of the day, they don't have any enforcement authority. The only people who can cancel these contracts at the federal level are Secretary Mayorkas and President Biden. And so we will continue to uplift these complaints, but we need the New Mexico legislature to step in because it's clear the executive will not.
I assume we'll see this bill again next year, Sophia.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming to talk to me about this today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks to Jeff and Attorney Sophia Genovese for that interview. Now, as we finish our look back at this year's regular 30-day session, we caught up with some policy advocates and lawmakers during their final days at the Roundhouse to talk about which legislation made it through both chambers and what didn't quite come together. First, Gwyneth chats with Tanis Fox, an attorney with the Western Environmental Law Center, about some of the proposals related to oil and gas development, including a reform of the Oil and Gas Act that didn't make it through. After you hear from Fox, Gwyneth then chats with Republican State Representative Jared Hembree of Roswell about what reforms the oil and gas industry may be open to next year. Here's Gwyneth.
Tanis Fox, your big issue this session was reform of the state's Oil and Gas Act. What happened?
This last session, there was a governor-initiated reform package for oil and gas, really to hold industry better accountable. This effort began really last year with legislation that we were pushing that would represent real reform of the 1935 Act, which hasn't been reformed fully since then. The governor initiated a working group last summer composed of industry representatives, NGO representatives like myself, and the state. And we worked on various issues really, really hard throughout the fall and winter. That effort produced a governor-led bill, HB 131, that was to be heard in the House Energy Committee. And once that bill was filed, things fell apart. And I guess, in a word, industry killed the bill. And it got out of two committees in the House, but could not get to the House floor. So for purposes of this short session, Oil and Gas Reform Act is dead.
But you did get some wins.
Absolutely, there are some wins this session for the environment. The legislature is going to fully fund the Land of Enchantment Legacy Fund. That's an amazing fund that helps fund state parks and soccer fields and protects lands all over New Mexico. That fund is now fully funded and sustainable, you know, in perpetuity. We got development money to protect New Mexico surface waters, our streams, our rivers, our wetlands that are really threatened right now in light of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision last year, Sackett versus EPA, which really shrunk EPA's authority to protect New Mexico waters. New Mexico waters are particularly at risk because of the nature of the decision and the numbers of waters, up to over 90%, that are now not protected by the federal government. So that development money, that seed money, is going to go a long way to helping to protect New Mexico surface waters.
There's some tax credits too, right?
There are seven tax credits that were passed, green tax credits that give tax credits for EVs, for geothermal energy, and the like. And those tax credits are really good. They will help low-income and middle-income people purchase EVs, and they are really good climate measures.
And heat pumps for people's homes.
Exactly. Everybody can relate to a heat pump, yes.
Representative Hembree, you're from Roswell. Oil and gas is the core of is the economic driver of your community. We were talking earlier about a big push to kind of reform the state's oil and gas law, right? And it looks like it didn't happen this session. Were there some changes that the industry supported that you think would have been helpful?
Yes, I think so. You know, the act as it was really disproportionately harmful to smaller independent producers, and that's a core in Roswell and Chavis County and the surrounding areas. There are things, though, that I think could be done that industry would support to address some of the same concerns as the what was in the Oil and Gas Act.
Can you give me an example of some of the ideas that you would support as updates?
Sure. So the Oil and Gas Conservation Tax was originated in the 1950s, I believe around 1959. And originally, that Oil and Gas Conservation Tax, which is still paid by every producer in the state, that tax originally went to the Reclamation Fund to address abandoned and orphaned wells. And we do have an abandoned and orphan well problem here. I think the current administration under Secretary Fuge is doing a very good job of addressing that with the funds they have.
But there's not enough money in the fund.
That's right. And part of that reason was because around 20 years ago or so, this legislature changed the way the oil and gas conservation tax was distributed. Rather than 100% of it going to the reclamation fund, it first went to the general, it now first goes to the general fund and is then appropriated to the reclamation fund. And currently only about less than 20% of all that tax goes to the reclamation fund. There's been some movement to change that back, or maybe not to 100%, but for a lot more of that money to go for its true intended purpose, which is the reclamation fund.
Thanks to Tanis Fox and Rep. Hembree for their time. Up next, Gwyneth chats with Republican State Representative Catherine Brown from Carlsbad for some perspective on a few bills and how they might impact cities outside the Albuquerque metro area.
Representative Brown, when you go home to Carlsbad after this session, what are you going to tell folks there that you're most proud of having accomplished up here?
There are several things that I think are really victories, assuming the governor keeps those intact. One of them for sure is transportation money for our roads in southeastern New Mexico. It is actually a big win. We started off with a recommendation of the extra revenue, $3.5 billion, zero was recommended by the Legislative Finance Committee for road repairs. And I think we boosted it to $220 million. I kept standing firm on that we needed to do more. And working through the process, we ended up with some good road money. And then there's something happening on the Senate side that may actually funnel into road projects that I identified particularly and ran legislation on to get funding for road work. Looking at Highway 308, 128, 285, and 31. So people in my district will know those numbers.
And you worked on some education issues too.
I sure did. So I've been a proponent for career technical education for many years, and last year we made some gains, $40 million statewide, and this year we're going to see about the same amount. And the idea is to just put these career tech programs in every school in New Mexico. We're talking junior high and up, and letting our students choose where to go with their talents and their interests. So we're seeing a lot of movement now on CTE, and I really am thankful that other legislators are on board with that now.
What are some of the careers that kids in Carlsbad could be going into that they could be working on while they're still in junior high and high school?
Sure. So at Carlsbad High School in particular, they have now the academies set up. And so students pick one to work through. And we do have some CTE lab renovations going on. So construction, auto mechanics, things in environmental pursuits, things like that. So there's quite a bit there now, but we need to expand those programs for sure.
Finally, the budget was of course the priority for lawmakers during this year's 30-day. And inside the nearly $10.2 billion package, there's some new money set aside for healthcare. First up, you'll hear from Republican Representative Jennifer Jones from Deming, and then Democratic Representative Kathleen Cates of Rio Rancho.
Representative Jones, you're a nurse. When you go back to Deming, what are you going to tell them that this legislature accomplished in terms of health care for areas like Deming?
Yes, well, I'm particularly proud of the fact that we were able to push through the rural health care tax credit that would include nurses and several health care providers in rural areas. It allows them to see several thousand dollars in their pockets. And that is a measure that's been, or a bill that's been put forward by Representative Miguel Garcia for many years now, I believe 9 years, but he's allowed me to partner with him and make that a good bill, and it's getting through this year. I'm really proud of that.
And we've had trouble with rural hospitals struggling to stay open. Is there some help for them here?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Yes, we have passed some legislation this year that will help those hospitals keep their doors open, and especially in the rural areas, because a lot of them are struggling. Some of them are having to close their doors for obstetrics. Women have to travel long distances in some areas of New Mexico to deliver their baby or to get proper health care when they're pregnant. So we're working on that, on funding those hospitals, making sure they can keep their doors open.
You serve on the House Health and Human Services Committee, and the legislature has done a fair bit in terms of health care this session. What are the highlights that you are proud of?
Well, I am proud that the committee recognizes that the health concerns of New Mexicans are complex and will not be resolved in one bill. So we are looking at drug transparency prices, rural health care, recruitment and retention of medical providers, disability access and opportunity, and many, many more to be able to create a comprehensive plan. And we're working on it year round to be able to address that.
And how will the new health care authority help?
Well, we will see. So as all-encompassing health care authority, they should have buying power to be able to lower some of insurance and drug prices. And that is the theory behind creating this new position.
Thanks for listening to the podcast this week. You can look back at all of our coverage from this year's legislative session online on nmpbs.org, on the PBS app, or on our social media pages. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Be sure to follow along during the week, too. And you can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, February 19th, 2024. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.